Good evening and welcome. My name is Jeanette Perez Rosello. I am a class of 1991 from the College of Human Ecology. I am currently a pediatric radiologist at Children's Boston Hospital, and I am also an associate instructor in radiology at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to this evening's feature event, The Value of Leadership in the 21st Century. A special welcome to the Cornelians that are joining us via Facebook. Tonight's event is brought to you by Cornell Mosaic and the President's Council for Cornell Women, where I serve as a steering committee member. We are in for an engaging panel discussion. Five fabulous Cornell women that are in the business of helping others see what is going on around the world. Before we get started, I would like to point out that we will not be taking questions from the floor audience. This is to respect our time constraints. However, all of you will have the opportunity to interact with the panelists during the reception. For the Twitter and live stream audience, we will select a few questions that you can submit by using the hashtag CornellCalc. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Kate Snow, a fellow 1991 classmate. She is a graduate from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences with a degree in communication. Kate is a correspondent for the Rock Center with Brian Williams. She's a former correspondent for Dateline NBC. And Kate continues to serve as a fill-in anchor for NBC Nightly News. She contributes to all platforms of NBC News. And throughout her career, Kate has covered breaking news, stories that affect parents and children, politics, presidential elections, White House, Congress, and many others. So welcome, Kate, and welcome to all the panelists.
Thank you so much. Can we get a little shout out for ALS out there? Can we get a little egg? Thank you. Because everybody up here on the stage with me, they're all arts.
Yay, art!
See, I knew that was gonna happen. I'm gonna introduce the panel real quick just so we all know who we are, and then we'll start right in with questions. We wanted to get right into it. But on my right, on your left, is Essie Cupp. She's a 2000 graduate. She is the youngest of us up here. She's the author of Losing Our Religion, The Liberal Media's Attack on Christianity, also the co-author of Why You're Wrong About the Right. She has a regular column that you may know about in the New York Daily News, and she's a contributing editor at Town Hall Magazine, also a regular contributor to Politico's Arena. Big TV commentator, if you watch, hopefully you watch MSNBC, but if you watch CNN or Fox or any of them, you've seen Essie. She's all over the place. Right here to my right is Cheryl Wu Dunn. She is the first Asian American reporter to ever win a Pulitzer Prize, which I think is a pretty darn big deal. She is also, she's known for a lot of things. By the way, no slackers up here. I'm just saying, not myself, but these four. Cheryl is the best-selling author of Half the Sky, which is a great book. She's a business executive. She's a lecturer. Currently, she's a senior managing director at Midmarket Securities and president of Triple Edge, which is a social investing consultancy. She's also a member of the Cornell University Board of Trustees. She's co-chaired the Academic Affairs Committee, former member of the University Endowments Investment Committee, and a member of the board's finance committee. So she's done just a little bit for Cornell over the years. All these folks. To my left is another Cheryl Tucker. Cheryl Tucker is a class of 78, award-winning business journalist, publishing executive. She's helped investors, corporate professionals, and companies build wealth, advance careers, grow philanthropy. That's been a big mission of hers, specifically helping people that have a lot of money find interesting ways to give it away, which is, I'm sure a lot of people in this room would like to see people invest in Cornell, so she's helping with that. She's also currently serving as a consultant to the Time Warner Foundation. So that's your big mission right now, is serving as a consultant to Time Warner on issues of philanthropy. She's also a trustee and chair of Mosaic, which you heard was sponsoring the event tonight. And then to my far left is Kathy Merrill Williams, 91, just like me. Kathy is owner. Was there applause out there for 91? No, right. Kathy is owner and publisher of Washingtonian Magazine Incorporated. If you live in D.C., you know exactly what that is. It's the media company that includes Washingtonian Magazine, one of my favorite magazines, leading monthly here in Washington. They have more than 300,000 readers. Also the popular local website, Washingtonian.com, Washingtonian Bride and Groom, Washingtonian Custom Media, and Washingtonian Events. They've got a whole thing going on. She is active in the community. She sits on 6 outside boards. She chairs 2 of those. She's a lifelong Washingtonian, lives in the district here with her husband and 2 kids. I think several of us have kids up here. We're moms as well. So that's our panel. And I want to start right in. I was trying to think about how to frame this. These women are all thought leaders. They're all leaders in their fields. And that's probably why you're here. And I wanted to start really big picture, since you're all successful leaders, and you've all worked in media, you're all sort of synthesizing the issues of the day and telling people what to think about. Essie, I'm gonna start with you, and I wanna go down the row. When we talk about leadership, and this is a big, broad question, but where do you see the biggest failure of leadership today?
Well, first, hello, and thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. And unfortunately, because I do speak for a living, my voice is going, I apologize.
We haven't even started yet.
If it gets grating, I know. If it cracks, I'm not getting emotional. I'm just, it's going. But yeah, because I cover politics, I guess I'll look to the current situation and say, without trying to get too partisan here, we don't need to fight, but I think the failure on the part of this administration, and frankly the administration before it, to address our economic issues in an effective and lasting way, I think has been the greatest failure of leadership that has affected all of us in every sector. And if you look back to the genesis of this economic collapse with Fannie and Freddie and the housing market, which started out as government influence over housing. I think it's a huge mistake that the last administration and this administration continues to exert government influence over so many aspects of our lives. And again, this is not an Obama thing. Bush did it as well. I think this culture that we live in, whether it's Hollywood, the media's to blame, and certainly a lot of our political leaders, have not remembered that we are a culture that should inspire personal responsibility and self-reliance. Those are not values that I think are being fostered by a lot of leadership right now. And that's unfortunate. We should be in positions to take care of ourselves. I mean, you know, we worked hard, we got where we got because we worked hard at it. And you know, we might have gotten some mentorship here and there, but I didn't get any handouts. I'm sure you didn't either. And I think, you know, we sit back and we wonder why, you know, kids grow up so lazy these days. And they are so lazy. Well, the culture around them really fosters that. And I think more personal responsibility in every aspect of our universe, our political universe and our media universe, I think would go a long way to solving so many of our issues.
Go ahead, jump in, Kathy.
I really don't think the kids are lazy. I think that, I don't. I think most people here who interact with Cornell students don't think that. We have a lot of young kids that come through our office that work for us. We have intern programs 3 times a year. I have a lot of young people on the staff who work really, really hard. Now, there's certain young students who have a sense of entitlement to what they want in a job. Fortunately, the economy has fixed a lot of that. What I saw 5 years ago is very different than what I see now, but I see people who graduate with a lot of debt, who work hard, who take extra jobs. I don't think that has fundamentally changed at all. People might want foosball tables and ping pong and all of this sort of stuff in their work atmosphere, but I disagree with you. I think the biggest failure of leadership is that we have too many people who put party over country. And that is the fundamental problem right now in our system.
You know, I think actually if you want to look at what leadership means, at least from the country's point of view, I think we can look at it from the political, from the military, and from the economic point of view. We used to have leadership in all three fronts. And I think that that is waning partly because we started taking things for granted. We went too far out on the military front, and we are setting a terrible example for the rest of the world, and we see the implications for all of that because of the two wars that we're playing. So I think that is an issue. And then on the economic front, I think we were dealt a bad hand. I think it was very difficult to put particular blame on the political leaders because, you know, they actually had to clean up this mess that, you know, was a result of a number of conspiring factors. But I do think that there has been, sort of a falling out of the kind of leadership that should have taken better care in stewarding the economic leadership. And we have this issue now in Europe where we really are taking a backstage, and because we just don't know what to do. And I think that partly it raises the question of, is there a systemic problem? Is the way we function in the government, is there something wrong with it? Because the two parties can't, you know, work together. There's, you know, static stasis in the government. There's nothing is operating very well. So I think people are asking the question, is there something in the way our system is organized that we have to change now because it was set up 200 years ago and it's not appropriate for now? But then I also want to say, even though we're criticizing all this, what would you do in those circumstances if you were in these leadership roles? It's not easy. And so I think it's, while we on one hand we'd like to criticize, if you were to put yourself in the shoes either of Obama, you know, of Ben Bernanke, you know, or of other people, do you really think that you could do a better job? It's not easy. John, it's humbling, Payton. In fact.
I have a challenge with not only our political leadership, but as a business journalist, in my vantage point of when I was an executive editor at Money or when I was the editor-in-chief of Black Enterprise, looking at the way that the business leaders make decisions, whether or not they really make sense in a long term. We watched the financial meltdown a few years ago, and we realized that a lot of things were built on policies and programs and products that were not built to last. They were definitely short-term kind of solutions to make money in a fast way, and there wasn't a sense of accountability of what would happen. And as a covering that, you would see these products come out, and you would see many of them that brought down some of the greatest institutions in our country in terms of financial companies. And you knew that they were, you know, bogus from the very beginning. But what were the ethical issues or values that were discussed in those boardrooms as they created these products and offered them and gave them to organizations, individuals, countries that would never be able to afford them? So this was not anything that should have been a surprise. And so it's, for me, one of the things that we need to really hold our leaders accountable is how they make decisions, their ethics and the values behind some of the decisions that are made.
But you're talking about corporate America, right?
I'm talking about all decisions. I agree with what everybody's saying, that that's as much important as our legislative leaders as well as our business leaders or our policy leaders. It doesn't really make a difference, but we need to think about how we make decisions and the impact of them, not just for our current use, but going forward.
How do you force that to happen, though, for example, in a corporate boardroom where money and profit is really the driving force?
That's a challenge. That's a true challenge when you have the cycles. I think that in some ways the organizations that were set to cover them, whether it's the media, whether it's policy makers, whether it's organizational leaders that are watchdogs for those organizations, really kind of let the American people down in that, where we did not really put the feet to the fire when some of these things came out, these decisions. There was kind of like a lot of people talking to each other about them but I'm not sure we really helped everyone else understand some of the pitfalls that were going to happen if it continued that way.
Okay, plug for women, a plug for women. So I know I'm borrowing and stealing from other people, but it has been said that if Lehman Brothers, the board of Lehman Brothers, or if the name of the company was Lehman Brothers and Sisters, that maybe there would have been actually a more diversity of opinion on the board, and they would not have made some of the decisions that they did. So
I was going to ask you, because you work in investment banking now. You've been a writer. You worked for the New York Times for a long time. You won a Pulitzer Prize, but you now are in investment banking, right? So as you view the world, is good leadership rewarded by Wall Street?
Is good leadership on Wall Street rewarded? I'd say that it's really the profit motive. There are great leaders, people who are great managers on Wall Street, I have to say. But that's because the goals that they are given is that they have to, enhance shareholder value. And so with that in mind, I think that was a lot of the issues related to what happened in the crash in 2008, is that they were very short-term oriented. And, when they were sort of trying to sell a deal to Turkey or to Greece, what was in their minds is, this is how much money I'm going to make. And so the top chief salesman is going to go out there. He may be the CEO of the company. He's going to go out there and say, yeah, this is what we need to do. We need to get this deal. So I think that, it's the reward structure. It's the incentive structure. And we are, dealing with CEO pay that is, I think many people would agree that it is quite high, right?
Astronomical.
And so there is something to be said when you see people working at nonprofit organizations, for instance, and they're barely making, ends meet, when they're doing good and they should be actually being paid more than people who are, selling other things that, probably aren't necessarily adding so much social value.
I think there's something to be learned about this in two things. One is that if you look at a lot of the leaders that we call leaders these days, we might want to wonder in grade school what grade they got in the work and play category together. Because clearly cooperation and leadership is an important important task that we should all think about.
Maybe they skipped kindergarten.
Yeah, maybe.
Does everybody on stage agree with this notion that if women were in more of the boardrooms, we're all women up here, so let's address the elephant in the room, right? Would women, you're making a face. Why are you making a face?
Because I don't love identity politics, and it was interesting last night at the debate. The four GOP contenders were asked to name some Hispanic Republicans that they would appoint to their cabinet or into their administration. And Romney ticked off a list of names, and then Newt Gingrich ticked off a list of names, and Rick Santorum ticked off. And Ron Paul was the only one who said, I'm not going to give you names. I would appoint the people who are most qualified. And that's the right answer. I don't think any of us on this stage are successful because someone came up to us and said, I need to find you a leadership position, plucked us out of a crowd and put us into a leadership position. So while it's good to see, 2010 was actually a banner year for women in politics, a lot of women running for office, and it's good to see more women in the boardroom, that's great, but I don't love the quota mongering, and I don't love the idea that we need to push an identity block into the forefront. I think we should search for the most qualified people and hope that they rise to the top and do the best job.
Okay, so let me turn this on you. And so let's say for the past few decades...
I see how this is going to go.
and I'm very even-minded about
this. It's okay.
But I'm actually very... But let's say if you look at the past few decades and you look at, Cornell University, other universities, and the makeup of the student body, it was probably predominantly male, right?
It's actually moving predominantly female.
Well, that's my point.
I'm sorry.
And so you see...
Got ahead of myself.
...that... elite educational institutions for decades have been, educating a field of many, many men. And that's why many, many men have gone into corporate America. So let's just say, if you were just to open the floodgates and let, anyone who is best qualified to get in, probably what would happen is that you would have more female students. So we've actually, because I think that in general, they tend to test better. I was talking to the dean of a school who said, my goodness, one year we did open the floodgates and we just did according to their grades and their stats, and we had 60% girls. We can't continue that.
Right.
So they actually tempered it down. But in some ways, if you think that we have how to balance it out and get more women into corporate America who are qualified, what if you actually just open the floodgates? You don't even have to do affirmative action for women in universities. And just, you know, have another couple of decades where there's mostly women. You'd flood the market with very, very qualified women, and maybe they would rise to the top.
Absolutely. That's a free market solution. Yep. I like it.
But wait, Cheryl, let me say that two thoughts on that, which is that there's this question about what is the goal for women. I never, right now, senior corporate executives that are women, women make about 14% of corporate executives. But there is this sort of notion that it should be 50-50, and it takes away from the fact that there are women who want to leave the workforce to raise their families. I mean, I have many great friends who are stay-home moms who do that. I am with Essie on this one, that you have to sort of pick the right person for the job. And we have these incredible women leaders now that are, I mean, the president of Harvard, of Brown, of Yale are all women. Corporate America, there's plenty of examples at Pepsi and Hewlett Packard was, and Xerox. Are all women. I think we spend a little too much time focusing on women. I have never had a piece of leadership advice that wouldn't apply equally to a man or a woman, with the exception of, if you're going to cry, make sure your office door is closed. Because I think that women can be a little more emotional. But I'm not such a women's person. I think we spend a little too much time focused on it.
But I think that the question was more women in the boardroom would make a difference, or in the conversation.
Positions.
But think about this, that diversity powers innovation. So that if you have different perspectives coming together to deal with issues, and you will have different points of view, different references, different accountabilities, different checks and balances. And when you have like minds all in the room together, then the idea that you might think outside of the box is pretty limited. And I think that in that sense, do women make a difference or not? The reality is that having a diverse experience to draw from will make a difference. And there was, and even within your own experience, I was reading a friend of mine's thesis, and it looked at what would make great nonprofit leaders, and would they come from the business sector versus the nonprofit sector? Which one, you know, is more likely to be the better leader? And her conclusion was it didn't really matter. What it mattered is how diverse the experience of was the leader. And if the leader was pushed out of his or her comfort zone more than just staying in one lane all the time, the likelihood that even within an individual, they would bring more experience and better leadership to the organization. So
yeah. No, I totally agree. I think that, look, we are different. And, you know, I don't want to say that I'm exactly like a man. I mean, you know, hopefully I wasn't chosen wrongly because I was only a woman. But I do think that we are different, and you always play to your strengths. You always play to your edge. And, you know, women are different from men. And I think that women in leadership positions does make a difference in many ways. It's not necessarily always good. It could be bad, but it makes a difference. It's a different, they lead differently. So, for instance, if you look at Secretary Clinton, and not all women lead alike either. So Secretary Clinton, I think that although she's done a very, very good job, she's logged a zillion miles, I mean, she's done a really good job in encouraging the State Department. The morale is very good there. I think she's, you know, protected her budget, and she's also, you know, done, given the challenge, she's done a good job on foreign relations. But I think the other thing that she has done that's made a difference is that she really has been a spokesman for women in the rest of the world. And that's something no other Secretary of State has done, even previous women. So it's not just the fact that she's a woman that she's doing this. And in the rest of the world, being a woman does count, because I think that there is discrimination against women. We're lucky here in the U.S. that it's a lot better than in other places. But being a woman does hurt you in places. It you know, it counts in other places. And if you can focus on the women in development, that does turn the tides.
Let me say, yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I'm talking domestically. Internationally, the only way we are going to fix some of the intractable economic issues in the rest of the world is to get women employed. I mean, that
Did you
is,
read her book?
That is, yes, yes. But that is clearly, when I mean here in America where we have come very far, you know, if you have 50% of a workforce that is not allowed to work, you're not going to get very far.
And so I don't mean to make a joke. I mean, you wrote about that extensively, and you talked about moral leadership and the role of women in to tell us what you mean by moral leadership.
Well, I think that it really sort of derives once a power has political, economic, and military leadership, which the U.S. has achieved in a way that no other country has achieved. The next step really is to use that leadership for something, to make the world a better place. And I think that the U.S. in some occasions, has taken a good stand. I mean, you know, you can agree or disagree, but Obama did take a stand when it, you know, came to to Egypt and to the Middle East on the democracy movement there. But in other cases, the U.S. has fallen short. So I think that, you know, you obviously have to pick your spots, but I think that the U.S. can do a little bit more on that front.
And I want to go back to Cheryl, because you were talking about whether women should be, how we foster women in leadership roles. Diversity officers, and this is a sticky subject, I know, but there are a lot of companies now that have chief diversity officers. Is that helpful? Does that help women? Does it help people of color? Or do we need more than that? Is it enough?
Well, I mean, I think a chief diversity officer is a signal to the organization that the leadership is comfortable with talking about diversity. However, I don't think that embodying that power in one person is far enough. First, you have to start off with bold leadership that's comfortable saying that diversity is part of our mission of what we're doing in the organization, that is connected to whatever the organization's bottom line is: engagement, money, profits, you know, whatever it is, influence. And then you need what I call local vocal advocates, people who will drive that diversity mission through the organization in a very meaningful way. But if the company hasn't figured out what the diversity is supposed to do, whether it's to drive innovation, as I talked about, drive creativity, to gain perspectives beyond the normal perspectives that might gather together, then the organization doesn't really have a rallying force around diversity, and that's when the organization's efforts usually fall apart. So if you look at some of the organizations where diversity is you have to do this and not do that, those tend not to work. When you offer something that I think is interesting of a way to customize it within the different areas of the organization, and they can take ownership in a very meaningful way, then that diversity officer has something to work with.
Can you give me an example? Or am I putting you on the spot?
Can I use the Cornell example?
Sure.
Do you mind?
What? Don't look at them. Yes, you can use it.
Charlie, hesitantly.
Okay.
You can say anything.
Right.
Don't look over there.
I know. I'd like to use this because it is something that we're all touched on, and I think it'll be very interesting and engaging. Instead of saying to all the different parts of the Cornell community, you have to do diversity this way or that way, giving the different administrative areas.
I was trying to fix it.
The different administrative areas, the schools, the staff, the different, you know, parts of the community, a menu of things to work on, and the identification of the resources of how to make those work, gives this effort a lot more chances of success than had everyone in Day Hall said, this is what you have to do, and this is the only way to measure success. So once you put a way for people to own that diversity effort, and then understand how it's going to be measured and what the accountability structure looks like, you will probably have a better success ratio than not. And I say this because I've covered diversity for most of my career and have done a lot of work with a lot of different organizations and corporations around diversity. And I'm sorry to say, for many of these organizations, the efforts did not pan out because there was never any local ownership of the effort. It was something that the boss said we had to do without a really understanding of how to get it done.
going to go back over to SE. Bring up politics again. I was in Florida for the debate that we... why are you laughing? Because I go to you on... because that's your thing.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
That is your thing. You told me that the other day. You said politics is my thing.
You're right.
I was in Tampa. NBC sponsored a debate on Tuesday. So I was in Tampa for that. And I went around and I was talking to Florida voters for a piece that we're doing for next week, for Monday. And I hope you'll all watch, please, because we need every viewer we can
These
get.
These are great plugs.
I know. Nice segue there. But no, but here's the thing. We were talking to Florida voters, a lot of undecided voters, a lot of anger at Washington, at this town, and a lot of sentiment, as you mentioned before, that just things just don't work. There's no unity. And you can't have leadership without unity. So instead of talking about the negative, though, my question is, how do we find unity? How do political leaders in this town come together? Where do you see us going? Is it possible? Please tell us something positive.
Gosh, I wish I could. You know, this intractability that has sort of marked the last 3+ years was both inevitable and not unique. Not the first time the House and the Senate or Republicans and Democrats have been at loggerheads, or that there's been a divisive kind of polarizing figure, whether that's Obama if you're on the right or Boehner if you're on the left. And let's face it, these issues are galvanizing. They are serious. People are passionate about them. Whether it's social issue or a fiscal issue, people are out of jobs. And there is one thing the American people have zero sense of humor on, and that is unemployment. You can be as partisan and gimmicky as you want about a myriad of issues, but when you start politicizing unemployment, the American people put their foot down and get really, really angry. They want solutions on unemployment, and they want them now. They don't care who gets the credit. So what you're seeing, I think, is the natural state of politics. I mean, this happens from time to time. Not everyone is getting along, and let's work for the greater good. And that really rarely happens. But it's amplified, I think, by the fact that the economy is bad, unemployment is high, and people want action in ways that are more immediate than they do on almost every other issue out there. They can wait on an immigration policy. They waited for 20 years on healthcare reform. They will wait, but they have zero patience when it comes to jobs.
So, Kathy, I'm going to ping pong over here because you live here, and we were talking on the phone the other day about this, that you see little examples of bipartisanship, if you will.
There's lots of examples of roadblocks and of lack of leadership on for the 535 people on the Hill. But there's a lot of examples in Washington of people who do great. And it is frustrating sort of as a native Washingtonian that you don't see it. Most people who work for the federal government are very, very committed civil servants who really do care deeply about this country. You will not find, thank you, for them. You will not find harder people, people who work harder than on the Hill. If you talk to AAs on the Hill, legislative, you know them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're there 100 hours a week, ignoring their families to a large degree. Yeah. Same with people in the White House. They care deeply. They might care too deeply. But there are, you know, I happen to live in between sort of one of a really well-known Republican lobbyist and a really well-known Democrat lobbyist who are they're together, they're at each other's houses, they you know, share parties, they're at the same fundraisers, and that's true of a lot. There used to be more of that. Ted Kennedy was great at inviting people over for dinner. If we had a little more Alan Simpson, Ted Kennedy-esque relationships, things would be a lot better. But in Washington, there is, on the next level down, a great sense of community, a great sense of caring among Senate and Hill staffers, among federal employees. It's not as politicized. It's just somehow or other, there's a real lack of leadership in that 535.
Is there some secret to getting them all to work together, to getting people to pull together on jobs? I mean, I think you're right.
There is a secret. There is a secret. When the country comes to crisis, they get together. Look what happened after 9/11, right? We had legislation within 2 weeks passed to set up a fund. It was unprecedented. It was full to pay victims. It was something that it had ethical problems written all over it. I saw Ken Feinberg, the Pazar. I had breakfast with him yesterday. People came to him.
Wait, I'm sorry, did you say you had breakfast with him yesterday?
Yes, with Ken Feinberg. He said, people came to him and said, my brother died in Oklahoma City. Why don't I get paid? My father died in the first World Trade Center in 93. I didn't get a check, but we came together, we did that. We came together for TARP. Paulson and Geithner worked well together in a transition. You might disagree with TARP, you might think it's a bad idea, they might not have implemented it well. They came together, they got something passed when we were on the brink of economic failure. I mean, there's examples and examples, but it seems to be only when the country really is screaming and yelling about one big issue, which I don't know why it doesn't happen on the deficit, because everybody knows that that's a mess and we can't get it passed there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a big part of this is that how, you know, it's kind of like back on the voters and how we choose our leaders. I think that you were saying that things may have to change, Cheryl. One of the issues is that picking leaders that actually understand economics is probably more important now than ever before. But if you ask most of the people, the voters, whether what they know about their candidates' understanding of the real issues of job development, business development, economics, they wouldn't know. They would kind of know the sound bites that went along with what they said about these areas, but do they know how much their understanding is? And so when you watch some of the, like when they were grilling the auto leaders, you could tell that some of the people in the room really actually understood what was happening with the auto industry, and you could see that there was a lot of people who didn't, the initial hearings, didn't understand it. And so I would almost want to send a lot of our elected officials to summer school and get...
Let me take that, though, because I don't know, it's a question for the audience. Maybe the problem is the other way, because I have thought about this as well, and I checked the stats on this. Our elected officials now are way more educated. I fear saying this at, in front of this great Cornell University sign, but 70% of the Senate has not a college degree, but has a higher than college degree, a master's or a PhD, and that's 50% on the Hill side. Maybe we need more Harry S. Trumans who didn't have a college degree, but some people who have some grit, I don't mean Harry S. Truman, but I mean we vote for people who show real leadership skills and grit instead of looking into their education or taxes.
Well, I think they're educated. I'm just not sure if they are knowledgeable about these issues.
I can't disagree. There's a problem up there. I just don't know what it is.
I think it's very interesting. And to your point, I mean, there is a difference between a degree and real life experience, whether that's leading a company or hiring and firing or whatever the discipline is. And I think one perfect example of that, at least on the GOP side, Mitt Romney is running as a private sector candidate, which I think marks the first time in history that someone has run away from their executive experience. The governorship used to be the upper echelon, unimpeachable qualification for a president to be. And here you have Mitt Romney going out saying, don't say the G word. Let's talk about the fact that I have been in the private sector for 25 years and ignore the fact that he would have been in the public sector had he been elected more often. it's fascinating. And I think a real sign of the times that you have a governor who is saying, let's look at my business skills and not my executive experience.
I'm going to pick up on, you teed this up perfectly because you're talking about education, and we have that Twitter and Facebook audience out there somewhere, and they're sending in their questions. So someone wrote, can higher education do anything to better prepare leaders for the challenges that we're talking about up here on stage? So what can Cornell, what can other bodies of higher education, institutions of higher education do, Cheryl, I'll put it to you, to help solve the crisis.
I think there are a number of things that we can do. I think that there is a crisis in education on several fronts right now. One is that what brought America to the place where it is, you know, the global leadership, is that we had education for the masses. I mean, that's, I know, you know, for everybody. We didn't really care whether you got, you know, a Cornell education or you got, you know, a community college education. In fact, what really makes a country tick and elevates the level of a country's, you know, economic prowess is better education at the community college level, because you just need to get everybody educated. And I think that we're dipping now on all of the global statistics. And we're like, instead of number one in terms of, you know, the best educated, the highest number of graduates from high school and from college, we're slipping to number 15, number 20. I mean, we're way down there. So I think there's been a failure there. Higher education can also help with secondary education. So it's not just that, you know, the higher education institutions can sit back and say, well, that's secondary education's fault. And higher education can play a role in trying to figure out what is the best way to really bring, again, bring us back to mass education.
Are there literally courses that should be taught that aren't being, I mean, I don't even, I haven't looked at the syllabus in a million years, so
I don't know
really what's being taught.
Cornell was where I think I really cemented learning how to be a leader, in the sense that it was a place where you were able to have an organization, there was always some funding available, there was always, reality is that the fact that I am on a trustee board is amazing to me. When I was in the university, I had a newspaper and a magazine, and sometimes I took the administration to task a lot in that. It was an independent publications. It wasn't part of the Cornell Sun. It wasn't part of anything. And it was amazing to me that there was always a dialogue that was going on. So if you have organizations, even more important than I think classes, where they really look at these organizations as important to helping develop leaders, sometimes supporting them while they're learning and doing is as important as any class. So in any kind of organization, you have to do a budget, manage people, and those kinds of things. And I think that universities have to take some of these student groups seriously in the sense of helping to look at the leadership. I know PCCW does a lot to make sure that the leadership of women that not only lead women's organization, but there's an encouragement to lead co-ed organizations as well, so that you don't see that drop off in junior and senior year that you see in women leaders in a lot of campuses.
And I meant to say the course catalog, not, I'm sitting here thinking, it's not a syllabus, it's a course catalog. Anyway, for those of you who are going, what is she talking about? Kathy, did Cornell make you a better leader?
You know, it's funny, I was thinking about this, we were talking about leadership, and it's, you know, it's this great field of study. Is leadership born or is it learned? I think Cornell gave me the opportunity to be a better leader. I don't think it made me a better leader. That being said, when I was thinking about it, I asked my assistant and several other people in the office, hey, I didn't even know it was going to come in as a Twitter question, but this, did your college help prepare you for leadership? And they said, across the board, they said, my high school did. My high school talked more about leadership. There was more clubs, more activities. I think everybody feels a little lost in college. You get there and you're trying to figure out which way is this. It takes you sort of 2 or 3 years to get settled before you know there's a good lunch at the Big Red Barn and you don't have to eat at Willard Hall every day. But I mean, who realizes that before? I don't know, is that still true? Is that, it? I mean, it took, you know.
Walsh had a really good lunch. When yeah. I was
but I don't know how to do it. I don't know how you teach leadership other than provide people the opportunity to get involved in a lot of things on campus. And the more things you get involved in, the more likely you are to grow to be a leader.
I think that's absolutely right. I was an art history major. Not using that at all today, but not, you know, to say that it wasn't a fun experience, and it was, I loved it, but, you know, no one on this panel talked about the class they took that, you know, gave them this opportunity for success. I worked at the Cornell Sun the 3 years that I was at Cornell, and that was where I learned not only what I wanted to do for a living, but probably the only time in my life that I'll ever get to tell other people what to do. I was an editor there.
I don't know about that.
Oh,
really?
No, absolutely not. No, I will be taking direction for the rest of my life. But I was an editor there, and
Wait until you have kids.
That was a leadership experience for me that changed the course of my life. And I think, you know, when you talk about the college experience, so many people focus on the curriculum. And so much of college is what happens when you're not in class. And that doesn't mean that, you know, the parties and all of that is the experience, but it's those opportunities to find out who you are, to find out what your career should be, to experience those leadership pangs and understand what that feels like and work with other people and boss other people around, in my case, which I did really well. That experience, you know, and even today, I couldn't tell you who I sat next to in art history class, but I run into people from the Sun everywhere. I can tell you Andrew Ross Sorkin's at CNBC and Mickey Rabkin's at GQ, and I mean, all the people that I worked with are in this business working, you know, with me today. Those are the experiences, and it won't be the Sun for everyone, obviously, but those are the experiences I think that you take beyond the classroom, beyond graduation, and into your future lives.
The professors out there. Are there professors here? There are professors cringing
Sorry, professor.
Sorry. Cheryl, someone else wrote in, and I wasn't going to go through this because I didn't know if it would be of interest, but someone wrote in on Twitter and said, how did the panelists make the transition from what they did at Cornell to where you are now? So I think it might be instructive. And let's go back to SEE and start there because you're the most recent grad.
Sorry to keep saying that.
I've forgotten. So you can remember. Everyone else can think while you're talking.
Well, again, I worked at the Sun, and I knew that I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know that I wanted to be a political writer. I just wanted to write. So I got writing jobs out of college, a bunch of different kinds. I worked at for travel magazines. I worked for the Bond Buyer, which was a municipal bond daily. Well, that was a mistake. I had zero business working there. And then I ended up at the New York Times for 8 years. And at that point, decided I wanted to write a book about politics. And I also went back to school and got a graduate degree at the same time. And that sort of ushered me into this political writing career. I literally like wandered in by mistake. I feel lucky that they let me stick around here. It just happened to be timing and sort of the political climate of the time was right. And you know, hard work.
Right. You did write a book. I mean, there's a little hard work in there. Yeah. Cheryl, same question. I'll just go down the line because
right.
I think people are curious the link between, because you are in a leadership position now. You're
right. I mean, my life has been so eclectic and strange. I mean, I think that probably the only link that I had to journalism when I was at Cornell was I was a pre-med history major, and I was just moving into the history department. I was talking to a professor, and I said, what am I supposed to do with history? Because he was trying to convince me to be a history major. He goes, well, you know, you can go into journalism. And at the time, of course, I was pre-med. I said, oh, he's nuts. Why would I ever want to go into journalism? But life is strange. And so I ended up in journalism, of course. And that was a wonderful profession. It's a great. And so history does prepare you for journalism. But I think also just what Cornell did for me was that it gave me an intellectual awakening. I mean, I just had great professors at Cornell, I mean, amazing professors who just opened my mind and allowed me to be more open-minded about things. So I was open-minded about journalism, and then I moved to other things. I was in banking. I mean, I've just done a lot of things, and I think that open-mindedness is really what I've taken from Cornell.
I think I knew I wanted to be a journalist from my freshman year running these two publications. So what I learned, though, is that you can affect change through the media. When we wrote about things, we did get calls from people. We did engage in dialogue with people. Sometimes we didn't do it in the most diplomatic way. We still got respect from the people that we were taking to task. And so it's been important for me to understand and use the media to help build understanding around different things. And I think that that has also, I think I learned a lot of compassion at Cornell through others. I was meeting people with different circumstances that I had. I grew up in a pretty suburban, middle-class life, and when I got to Cornell, my roommate was from a rural area, that in New York State, which I didn't even know New York State had rural areas, because all I knew was New York City. So it did give me, I met more international people than I ever did, and it definitely gave me a compassion to help others and to work with others, which is now blossoming itself in my new career choice in philanthropy.
I think, Kate, you and I were talking about this earlier. Some people graduate and they just have this sense of this is what I want. Right. And then I say other, but I think most people graduate and really don't have a great idea what they want to do. So I fell into the great, unwashed masses. I went to work for a think tank because, you know, academia, thinking thoughts seemed good. it was slow paced. I had been history and government. And that led me to some campaigns. It wasn't until I was sort of in my mid-20s that I figured out that what I really liked was business. And I had worked for a year for a company and discovered that, boy, those accounting guys in the corner, they're interesting to me. What are they doing? What does profit margin mean? I'd been pretty strong in math. That led me into consulting, into business, but life, weird things happen in life. I spent 5 years running EasyPass, working for Michael Huerta, who's now head of the FAA, a toll chick, that's what we would always, the girls, very few girls in transportation, working on toll systems. Anyone who's driven through Route 1 on the Jersey Turnpike, I've walked that as a construction site many, many times. So it wasn't, even though I grew up in a journalism family, it was business, and then I ended up the old-fashioned way, in our family business. But I consider myself more of a business person than anything else.
I didn't know that. I thought you were journalism background. Did you get an MBA?
No, I got a master's in public administration and an MPA. So life has, as Cheryl said, eclectic corners that take you places. But if you work hard, which I think most people do, Essie, and I wanted to say from the opening shot, there is a guy over here in the front row I'm going to point out who came up to me before the panel. He's a junior in a high school here in Washington who writes on his school paper, wants to go to Cornell, talked his way in to come here today. It's Friday night. I'm sure there's other places he'd rather be. If that's not a hardworking guy,
seriously,
Charlie, you should get him an interview.
Now I lost my train of thought.
Sorry.
Where are we going?
You work hard, you do well, that's how you end up.
I actually kind of say that every time someone, because I get those phone calls too. How did you end up at NBC? And it wasn't exactly a straight line. It took a long...
How did you get there?
Well, thank you. mine's a long story, but basically WVBR. Which is the voice of the Big Red, which is still exists. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Still exists on campus, slightly off campus. When I was there, it was on Linden Avenue in that really nice building. Does anyone know? It's still there, right? You live on Linden Avenue. It's right there. I worked for WVBR. I got into it thinking that I was going to be a radio DJ and ended up in the news department by accident, honestly. Went there with my dorm mate, and she and I were going to be DJs. Next thing I know, I'm covering the Ithaca City Council and loving it. And went from there into radio, went to grad school along the way, couldn't get a radio job, so I went to grad school. And then after that, went to CNN as a producer and a booker, and then decided I'd want to ask the questions on TV rather than being behind the scenes, and went out to New Mexico. I told you it's a long story. I worked my way back. Worked my way back from New Mexico, Atlanta, D.C. I was here for 5 years covering the Hill, covering the White House, and then moved to New York for Good Morning America and now for NBC. So that's kind of my trajectory. But, it's what you said about the sun in my case, too. I got a lot of great experience at VBR, but I also was a communication major, and I have to give some kudos to the comm department for a lot of the coursework that I had because it really did help. Prepare me. There's a news writing class that I will never forget that still, to this day, I think back to in my head when I'm writing stories. So anyway, that's my brief story. It's not about me. You are the panelists here. So I want to change subjects if I can, because Cornell just won this really big bid. It's gotten a lot of attention where I live in New York City. If you don't know, Probably everyone in the room knows this, but they just won a bid against other universities to build a brand new applied sciences campus in New York. And this is a really big deal. This is a huge donation came in. It's going to be a big deal, big campus. What would you panelists tell Cornell leaders as they envision this and prepare to build this campus? What advice, if I may be so bold, what advice would you give the leaders of Cornell in terms of what to do, what not to do? You're looking at me quizzically. I won't start with you, then I'll go I'll go this way.
I would say Kathy. Clone Chuck Feeney first would be the number one thing. I mean, it is a great thing for Cornell. I think it presents some challenges as well, having a dual campus. So be strategic about what is there. The classic undergrad education. I think Cornell will always be Cornell. I hear there are people that think, oh, Cornell's moving to New York. That's insane. I mean, that is insane. Cornell, Ithaca is always going to be a great campus. But this gives Cornell quite an advantage to find people jobs, to have access to the great brain trust that's in New York, and to help be part of a redevelopment of an area that needs redevelopment. I think it's exciting.
Michelle, you talk so much about global education. Right. I imagine this fits right in with what I'm guessing you think needs to happen.
I did say this before to some of the people at Cornell, and I really do feel that this is an opportunity. It is transformative for Cornell. And I do think it's an opportunity. If you look at what Schumpeter says about creative destruction, Cornell has a chance to build something very organically from the very beginning. And it is a moment where all of you, each one of you, if you have a point of view, if you have a suggestion, send it in, because I really think that they can build this right now. I mean, it's like taking, you know, it's the most advanced that we can create, that we can be in creating a new institution from scratch. So let's get it right and let's do it fabulously well. So each one of you, please think about it.
I think I would push again that, you know, diversity powers innovation, and I think the fact that there was such a coalition of diverse people that were pulled together to help, you know, get this initiative passed, and I think the leadership of Cornell reached out in many, many ways, and I think there are a lot of leadership in our midst in this tech area, you know, science area, and so I also think that the strength of this will be how we leverage all that we are to bring this to bear. And also connecting into the one thing that I would love to see, it was brought up last week at the Pan-Asian New Year Festival that CAAA put on. One of the local politicians talked about connecting into the public schools. I think this is a very visible and significant nod to the importance of STEM and getting younger people involved in science and technology and engineering and mathematics, and getting them not at just the high school level, but bringing it down so they start getting involved in fourth grade, so they get the math and science they need to be able to get into a Cornell. So we hope that we make that connection strong and really bring out some interesting programs that the public schools can take advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, well, as Cornellians, you know, it's hard. Ithaca's not an easy place to get to. So it's always nice to see Cornell expanding its reach beyond, you know, Lake Cayuga. It's hard to get to. We were talking earlier. I am on another board at Cornell. They have meetings every winter. I can't go always. And whether it's Cornell in Qatar or Cornell in New York City now or Cornell across the country, that expansion of reach is something all of us look for. This event, this alumni event, where you are all here in one place, is a perfect example of how we live beyond graduation and extend our experience out into the world and out into years after we leave. So I think that's a huge benefit for all of us in the Cornell community.
We only have about five more minutes, so I could, because there are drinks waiting, in case you didn't know. So, so just quickly, I just have one more, and this is sort of a big, broad topic, but President Obama today I emailed all of you about this earlier. President Obama was in Michigan today talking about affordability and access to education, to higher education. And he brought it up in the State of the Union. If you saw the State of the Union the other night, he's got some proposals. Obviously, they're his Democratic proposals, haven't moved forward yet. But today he was talking about giving more federal grant money to colleges that contain tuition, the rise in tuition. So universities that perform well on not having tuition go up and up and up will actually get more federal grant dollars. What do we think about that? What do we think about affordability? I mean, I'm saving already for my 6 and my 9-year-old in case they want to go to Cornell. I'm dead serious.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I don't see how you cannot like it. The question is how do you implement it and where do you get the funds to do it? But I do think making it more affordable and reaching out to more people, we need mass education. We need education for everyone, not just the people who can get into Cornell.
You're on the board. You're on the board. I mean, I don't even understand how it works. Can tuition be contained? Can the growth be contained?
It's difficult to contain the growth. Growth has some funding responsibilities to it, and so unfortunately, I think we will see tuition increases. Whether over the years, we try not to make them for just doing them for doing them sake. But I think what's most important is that the universities, and Cornell's one of them, making a bigger commitment to make sure that the school is affordable to more populations than who can naturally pay for them. And so that's where philanthropy becomes really important, because we want to be able to be that school that any student can learn. But for certain schools with certain growth factors, tuition increase is going to be a reality. The other end of that is how do we help those who deserve to be here afford to be here?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure, we'd like to make college more affordable. That said, I'm not sure everyone should go to college. We are a nation of thinkers. We don't build anything anymore. I thought it was a striking sort of disconnect in the State of the Union when the president said we need a return to manufacturing and everyone needs to go to college. I don't know who's working in the factories if we're all in school. We need more, as you said earlier, community colleges that can better service people, that are more affordable, that are better quality schools. We need a return to vocational education. I haven't seen a trade school in years. We need to be teaching people how to learn skills, marketable skills, in addition to, the intellectual scholarship that we all benefited from. That's great. But maybe a return to manufacturing would be eased along the way if we weren't all in school.
Essie, if you return to manufacturing or go into manufacturing, you need a college degree that's not sitting there sewing on a button.
It's not true.
This is the computer robotics. This is supply chain management. This is a lot of education is required. And there's a lot of trade schools, and there should be more community colleges.
A lot of education is required for certain jobs. But a return to manufacturing, factories are shuttering their doors, not because they don't have enough highly qualified robotics trained.
But you can't tie factories to manufacturing to education. I mean, you can't separate manufacturing
sure
and education.
Sure you can.
Now it's getting really juicy.
We managed to keep it.
We need to do this over cocktails.
Is it time for cocktails? I think we've gone over. I was just checking
my
phone.
It's
we've gone over.
Wine.
I want to thank everyone. Are you going to thank everyone?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Kate, S.E., Cheryl, Kathy and Cheryl for a thought-provoking and very entertaining conversation. And I really want to invite everybody to continue the conversation outside with a lot of wine. And then thank you all to our Facebook audience that joined us all the way from Australia also. And at 7:30, please join us to root for Cornell versus Colgate at the hockey game. In the lobby bar, so we hope to see you there too. Thank everybody for attending today.